This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In 1872, an African-American man was born to parents who had been slaves in Mississippi. Through a series of adventures and misadventures, that man, Frederick Thomas, ended up in Russia, where he became both a citizen and a millionaire. His rags-to-riches story was evidently well-known during his lifetime, but it's since faded into the mists of history until a Yale professor of Slavic languages and literatures stumbled upon him while researching Russian immigrant culture in the early 1900s. What Dr. Vladimir Alexandrov discovered became the basis for his book, The Black Russian. Dr. Alexandrov will be at Malaprops in Asheville tonight at 7 and at UNC Charlotte on Wednesday at 2 and joins us for the hour. Thanks for being here. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yours is the first book that we have talked about in I cannot remember how long it's been, because I've done this show for a long time, that does not have a subtitle.
Right.
They all have subtitles. Now, how did you manage that?
Well, it was because Thomas wasn't known, and the publishers, my editor and I, thought that having an intriguing title, which we thought The Black Russian would be, might get people to pick it up, and then everything would flow from that.
So he didn't need to be the Black Russian, the man who came from slavery in America.
We tried that. We couldn't quite get it into anything succinct enough to work. So we decided to make it what we thought would be tantalizing.
Well, it's actually refreshing because usually to give the book title of a book these days takes most of the program. So it's a good thing. You are a scientist turned language expert and an avid tennis player who gave up tennis, I understand, to write this book.
I am, yeah.
What was so intriguing about this man, Frederick Thomas, that became so all-consuming for you?
It was the incredible changes that this man underwent in his life. Who could have imagined that somebody with his background in the deepest part of the South would wind up being in as exotic a place as Russia was in the 1890s, early 1900s for most of Americans? It was the unlikeliness of it all. There were very few black people of any kind in Russia around 1900 and before the revolution of 1917. For example, Moscow had a city population of about 1 million, mm-hmm. and I don't think there were more than 10 or 12 permanent black residents of any kind in the city at that time. So for somebody who goes from one of the blackest parts of the United States, Cahoma County, Mississippi, to one of the whitest cities in Europe was very striking. And I had to figure out how that happened, why it happened, and how he could succeed.
Yeah. How did you run across him in the first place? How did you discover him?
Well, I remember the moment because it changed my life. Mm. I was reading the memoirs of a Russian singer, Alexander Vertinsky, who was very popular during the First World War in the 1920s when he emigrated. And he was describing how he fled from the Bolsheviks in the south of Russia in 1920 and wound up in Constantinople, which is what Istanbul used to be called. And then he wrote, and here I translate from the original Russian, "I began to perform in the entertainment garden of our famous Moscow Negro, Fyodor Fyodorovich Thomas, the owner of the famous Maxim in Moscow. And I remember that I stopped reading and put the book down because I'd never heard of anything like this, and I'd worked a fair amount in that particular area. And so I began to dig, and I dug through Yale's vast libraries for a while and found very little. I got more and more intrigued with every slight little nugget that I found. And so first, out of sheer curiosity, I wanted to learn more about him, and I did research in various places. And then I decided, once I reached a tipping point in finding information about him, that this remarkable man's life needed to be resurrected mm-hmm. and returned to public memory.
Well, you say that he was well-known in his lifetime. Where was he well-known? Only in Russia or on all over the world? And what does that mean, to be well-known in the early 20th century?
In Russia, he was very well-known because he owned a couple of night spots that were central to Russian nightlife from about 1911 through 1917, through the time of the revolution. Remnants of both of his properties exist in Moscow today, although very few people recognize them for what they are. But there was this vast multi-acre entertainment garden called Aquarium, which is in all the tour books. If you look at the Baedeker Guide to Russia from 1914, it's one of the places that's recommended. The Maxim complex of nightclub and theater that's also in the center of Moscow within sight of the Kremlin was also on all the short lists for tourists who are coming. And occasionally, although not as much as to, say, Paris or Berlin, Americans came to Russia before the revolution, before the First World War, as tourists. And many of them wanted to see the famous sites, which included Thomas's properties, and they couldn't get over the fact that these famous places were owned by a Southern American black man. The same thing happened in Constantinople once Thomas went through the various complications of getting there and reestablishing himself. He opened a place called Maxim again in honor of the one that had been in Moscow, which, of course, were all in honor of the one in Paris. And this became the night spot in this very interesting city in the 1920s. So when tourists started coming on cruises to Constantinople, when they were on their Mediterranean cruises, they all trooped to Maxim. And then when they got home, they would write letters to the editors of local newspapers and in memoirs would recall how they could not believe that this super fancy nightclub with the best jazz in the city and with the most beautiful Russian emigre waitresses and delicious food was run by a very jovial, very sophisticated American black man from the South. So that's how word of his fame got back to the United States. And as far as people in Constantinople were concerned, the city up through 1923 was filled with thousands of allied officers, seamen, soldiers, diplomats, businessmen. It was a very international place. The one place that they all wanted to go for a good time was Frederick Thomas's Maxim.
We'll talk about what Maxim was in Moscow and what his place in Constantinople was like and what it meant as we go through the program. But why? Given his fame and all these letters floating around about tourists after discovering who owned these places, why did he fade into relative obscurity, complete obscurity?
Well, in the United States, he faded into relative obscurity primarily for racist reasons. White America in those days was not interested in celebrating black achievement, especially if it was taking place halfway around the world. So when the tourists wrote letters or reminiscences about having run into Thomas, when the letters were published in newspapers, there was usually some kind of a tone of white racist attitudes toward Thomas as well. Why his memory faded in Russia is due to the revolution that happened in 1917. The fact that Thomas had been an oppressed black man in the United States before he came to Russia didn't make any difference to the Bolsheviks. They saw him as being on the wrong side of the class war. He had become a rich man in Moscow.
In fact, had become a Russian citizen.
Yes, he did.
Which meant he had to pledge his allegiance to the Tsar.
That's right, in a purely formulaic way, but he did do that.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, they took away all of his properties, and he had to flee from Moscow. So the Soviet system was not interested at all in perpetuating his memory.
So they just erased him.
They erased him. And in fact, in the places in Moscow that are connected with his past, there are no indications that he was the owner, for example. Similar kind of thing happened in Constantinople, because in 1923, the Turkish Republic was established. And it tried to erase a lot of the influences that Europeans and other foreigners had in the country, the kind of privileges that they had been given under the Ottoman regime. Foreigners were treated differently prior to 1923 than they were afterwards. And so for local historical reasons in Turkey, Thomas was erased as well. His property survived when he lost it. It was taken over by Turks who ran it for decades afterwards, but without him.
And his story is one of coming from a very unlikely background for what he ended up doing, to not only doing it, but doing it several times, recreating himself after disasters several times.
Yeah, no, he really pulled himself up by his bootstraps repeatedly, but he got his wings from his parents, who were very unusual people.
Yeah.
They had been slaves until emancipation, and then a few years after the Civil War ended, they did a remarkable thing. His father was able to buy a 200-acre piece of land in Cahoma County for $20, spread in payments over 3 years, and that immediately launched this black family into a very unique position.
Which was also highly unusual for the time. Vladimir Alexandrov is our guest. His book is called The Black Russian, and we'll be exploring the life and times of Frederick Thomas as we go through the hour. Your research to uncover his story has been described as exhaustive. Actually, it's as interesting, I think, as the story that you uncover in the book, because as I mentioned in the beginning of the program, you were an avid tennis player, and you gave up that, and you used an entire sabbatical from Yale, which is something that professors cherish, I'm sure, to do the research on this. And you said that no detail was too small to pursue because I never knew where a particular strand might lead, and that without chance and luck, even the most diligent researcher could fail to get very far. What was your process, and where did it take you?
It took me to foreign countries. I did research in Russia, in Turkey, in France, in England, and in various places in the United States. And the slightest hint of a lead was enough to make me want to pursue it. I was prepared to go to Buenos Aires. I was prepared to go to Rotterdam because I thought originally that there might be information there as well. Let me give you a concrete example of how you can enhance your own luck when you're really dedicated to something. And I was caught up in a kind of a detective-like quest to find out as much about Thomas as I could. I did a lot of research in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and at their facility in College Park, Maryland. And I once found an index card that said in one of the files, Thomas, Frederick Bruce, death of in Constantinople. And then there was a number. And I said, this is obviously something I have to see. Mm-hmm. I asked the archivist to help me find it. One of them took a real interest in this and spent the better part of 2.5 days looking for it. Now, the archives are vast. They have miles and miles and miles of materials. He couldn't find it. He said, sometimes there are index cards to materials that have been destroyed. So I went home, but I didn't give up. I started digging through the labyrinth of the National Archives webpage, which would lead you from one site to another and then to a file that has hundreds of pages of listings of documents in it, and lo and behold, after hours of this, I came across something called the Cutter file, which had a prefix, 130, which was the prefix to the number that I had found. The next time I went to the archive, the archivist brought me two dossiers, over 100 pages of materials, which were the tipping point that I mentioned before that made it possible for me to write the book. Among other treasures in those dossiers was a 7-page typed summary of Frederick Thomas's life that he had dictated to an official in the American Consulate General in Constantinople, which told me where he was from, because up until that point I had no idea. Yeah. It said Friars Point, Mississippi, and that was the beginning of my quest in Mississippi later.
Vladimir Alexandrov, our guest, the Yale professor and professor of Slavic language and literature and the author of The Black Russian, the story of Frederick Thomas. We're going to find out more about Frederick Thomas and about Mr. Alexandrov's quest to find out more about him when we continue Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Dr. Vladimir Alexandrov, a professor of languages and literature, Slavic languages and literature at Yale University, and author of The Black Russian, which is the story of Frederick Thomas, an African-American man born in 1872 of former slaves, parents who were former slaves, and went on to become highly successful, a millionaire in Moscow in the early 20th century and later in Constantinople. And the research that you did to find this guy, because you just popped out of a book that you were reading, it intrigued you, and you just kind of devoted the next several years of your life to the research on this, which was unbelievably painstaking. Although you began on Google, it was not just a Google search. It took you everywhere, all over the world, into archives and libraries. What kept you going? Because you had no guarantee that this was going to pan out or that this guy would prove to be interesting. So what?
Oh, I knew he was interesting from the start, simply because of the distance in every conceivable sense, in terms of geographical distance, cultural distance between Cahoma County, Mississippi, mm-hmm. pre-revolutionary Tsarist Moscow, and Constantinople. The kind of electric tension almost seemed to spring into existence when you thought about how far away these places were in these various ways of thinking about them was enough to keep me going. And I kept finding things. There was a lot of good luck involved, but a luck that, as I said, you can try to enhance by being diligent. I would run through a fallow period, and then I would find something that would thrill me. I remember moments when I would get a volume of documents in some archive or a box of folders. I had reason to suspect that there would be something in there that would be of interest, and I would pause to savor the moment before I opened it, because you never knew. Sometimes it would be nothing. Sometimes it would be some entire episode in his life that would be revealed. And that's what kept me going, because I did keep finding things. Mm-hmm. But after a while, I think I stopped finding things because I didn't know where else to look, or I looked everywhere I could think of. And by then, I had enough material to get a feel for the character and to be able to describe all of the major events of his life. And that's when I started the third phase of writing it up.
You ultimately found his grandson in Paris.
Oh, yeah.
And that was kind of a story in and of itself, how you ultimately connected to this man. How much information was he able to give you?
That was another fascinating aspect of all of this. Finding him was a complex matter, but I succeeded in the end. He was a very welcoming fellow. He was very surprised to hear from somebody like me. And I remember when I went to see him in his very nice apartment in Paris, he was very hospitable. He allowed me to record his recollections. He didn't have anything written, but his recollections about his grandfather. And I dutifully recorded all of this. I gaped at the story. And then when I started doing my own research, I discovered that a large part of what the grandson told me was invention. But it was invention that was telling, in the sense that it also showed you something about the family that preserved this.
Was it purposeful on his part, or was this simply lore that was handed down to him that he took as fact?
It was handed down to him by his father, mm-hmm. whose name was Michael, Mikhail in Russian, who had been born in Moscow in 1905. He was one of Frederick Thomas's children and the only one who actually had a successful life after Thomas himself died in Constantinople in 1928. Michael wound up in Paris, and that's where the grandson was born. Mm-hmm. And I think the source of the invention was Michael in Paris and not Frederick way back when in Moscow or Constantinople.
You have since, I assume, gone on to share Frederick Thomas's real story that you uncovered in the course of your research with the grandson. What was his reaction to the mythological version being blown up?
He was very disappointed. He said that the very romantic story of his grandfather that he had heard from his own father had helped him win the hands of the two women he had married. And so here I was presenting him with a true story, which was not nearly as romantic, but in a way I think it was even more amazing.
He thought his grandfather was a mixture of Native American and African American.
And white, yeah.
And white and blood.
From New Mexico.
From New Mexico, but he was not.
No, he wasn't.
Did that make it? Is that why? We'll talk about this. There is a restaurant in the basement of what used to be Maxim's Theater.
Right.
In Moscow that is called Mulat
Tomas.
Tomas.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that Mulat is Russian for mulatto.
Exactly.
Is that why it's a mulatto? Because they thought he was a mixture?
Well, the people in Russia who opened that restaurant, which has folded since, by the way, knew virtually nothing about Thomas. I went there when I was in Moscow to check it out. It was an appealing little place. Mm-hmm. It bore no resemblance to the original establishment, and they knew nothing about the man himself. I think they added mulatto because it made it sound more exotic.
Ah.
But the story with the family sort of oral history that I was told is that it overlaps with a kind of a myth that exists among black Americans today. Henry Louis Gates, the eminent scholar at Harvard, has done a lot of work on African-American genealogy. He's had PBS programs about this and includes DNA testing. And he has found that it is fairly common among some black Americans to claim Native American ancestry. Mm. But the genetics prove that it was very little of that actually present. And so the reason for this story being generated is to somehow diffuse the association with slavery. It sort of makes the person have a more interesting past than saying that they were slaves prior to emancipation. And so that's, I think, what was behind Michael's invention of the family history that he passed down to his grandson. And also, I mean, part of the other story was that Frederick Thomas did not work his way up from the restaurant floor, which is actually what he did, but that he was a smuggler in the South China Sea and that he had saved the rich Russian's life in a bar in Shanghai, as a result of which the rich Russian took him with him to Russia and set him up. Yeah. These are the kinds of stories that the grandson had heard from his father, but which were simply not true.
The Horatio Alger story is a better story. Maybe they have a different sensibility over
maybe
there.
So, yeah.
You begin your book with the harrowing description of Thomas and his family leaving Odessa in the middle of the night, or trying to leave in the middle of the night, as the Bolsheviks pushed their way into that port city during the revolution. Thomas was born in 1872, son of former Mississippi slaves. He spent his youth on what you describe as his family's prosperous farm in Mississippi. Before we get to the harrowing exit from Odessa, which begins the book, let's go back to the beginning of his life. How did that happen? How did his parents have the $20 that it took to buy the farm? They were free men after the end of the Civil War.
Right.
And just a few years later, they had $20 saved up to buy this farm, which $20 in those days was a lot of money.
It was a lot of money. They didn't have to pay $20 up front because they had bought the farm over a period of 3 years. So they needed to pay $6 and change every year. Mm-hmm. I don't know for a fact where they got the money from, but I researched how it was that freedmen could have accumulated that kind of money by doing the kind of sharecropping work that most of them did after the Civil War. And I found lots of records, contracts between white planters and black families that were hired, and the kind of wages that were paid to families, assuming that the black workers were not cheated and so on, which happened a fair amount of the time. It was perfectly feasible for a diligent family to accumulate, say, $6.
Plus, he knew what he was doing as a farmer.
Yeah, because, I mean, look, most black Americans were agricultural workers when they were slaves. So they certainly knew how to farm, because after the first season of farming their own land, the census of 1870 reported that the total value of their property, and this is in 1870 dollars, was $5,000.
Wow.
Which is an enormous sum of money. It's something like 80 to 100,000 now.
But even you say that they found themselves, his parents found themselves, in the smallest of minorities.
Absolutely.
Black landowners in the deep, deep South,
right,
after the Civil War. I'm surprised, actually, that they were allowed. Because wasn't there a system of tenant farmers?
Sure.
How were they allowed to buy the
farm? Well, it was Reconstruction in those days. So the situation politically and socially and economically for black people in the Deep South was different than it became later, when Reconstruction faded and the South reasserted its attitudes towards black people. But in 1869, you know, the early 1870s, opportunities for black people to participate in the political and economic life of the South were much greater than later.
And so
they were able to do it.
And the story of his parents' struggle to keep this farm, which they ultimately did, in fact, lose,
yes,
could have been a book unto itself, it seems to me, because these are very successful, industrious people,
yeah,
who were essentially swindled.
Right.
But they also got their day in court, which is remarkable in itself in the South.
It is remarkable.
In the late 1800s.
Yeah, it reflects on them in terms of what kind of strong characters they were, what personalities they had, that they would stand up for their rights to the point of suing the rich and well-connected white landowner who tried to steal their land in a local court. Now, it wasn't simply, I don't think, a matter of truth and justice triumphing, because there were lawyers involved. And this black family was able to get onto their side a couple of very well-connected white lawyers who were opponents of the white planters' lawyers for local political reasons. So I think that the Thomas Land case became a kind of, in part, a pawn in a white power struggle in Cahoma County. And that is probably why, on the local Chancery Court level, the Thomases won the first round. Wow. This went to the Mississippi State Supreme Court. It was confused and muddled. I think there were probably political considerations there as well. But in the end, they decided by 1890 that it was safer to get out of harm's way and to abandon their legal struggle, at least not participate in it, by being in Cahoma County and move to Memphis.
And obviously, Frederick moved with them to Memphis. That's where his father would die.
Right, under circumstances that we hope the readers of the book will enjoy.
It's pretty brutal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's brutal.
But I don't want to give the spoiler.
All right, darn. because they ran a rooming house. They ran a boarding house.
Right.
We'll just let it go there. But in that boarding house, some things happened that resulted in Frederick Thomas's father dying. And he then left Memphis and moved on. He didn't go directly to Russia from there. He went to a lot of different places.
Yes, he did.
First Chicago, New York, other places in Europe. Where did he go from Memphis and why?
Everywhere he went was breaking the mold. In 1890, when he left the South, young black men who had grown up on farms in the South didn't go to northern cities, they went to southern cities.
Hmm.
The Great Migration, as it's called, when hundreds of thousands and millions of black people streamed to northern cities, didn't begin until after the First World War. So Thomas's move to Chicago in 1890 was very unusual. Chicago at that time had a population of, I calculated, of 1.3% were black people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he began to learn urban skills, which proved to be invaluable for him later on. He became a waiter and a valet. He was restricted in what he could do as a black man in the North, but he became very good as a valet and a waiter, which allowed him to pursue that profession in New York. He lived in Brooklyn, actually, which wasn't part of New York City in those days, but the entire New York area also had a minuscule black population then, about between 1% and 2% of the population. And he rose quite high in his profession of valet and a waiter. But he had a passion as well, which was singing. He took voice lessons from a German emigre music teacher in Manhattan. And he is the man, the teacher is the one who suggested to Thomas that he go to pursue his passion for singing abroad. He specifically recommended London.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this was because there would have been a racial barrier to Thomas being able to study singing the way he wanted to in even the North, like New York. And so going to Europe was another breaking with the mold of the past for young black men. This was decades before black Americans began to expatriate themselves. But once Thomas landed in London and once he began to zigzag across Europe, he discovered that there was no racism against black people in Europe, which was a great surprise to white Americans who went to those places later on, too.
Yeah, you say he experienced the colorblind freedom of Western Europe.
That's right.
Vladimir Alexandrov, I keep wanting to call you Alexander, but Vladimir Alexandrov.
It's been done.
is our guest. His book is called The Black Russian, and that black Russian is Frederick Thomas, this morning on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. How educated was he prior to becoming a valet and a waiter?
He began his schooling in the Thomas Chapel. His parents were very committed to the local black community, and in 1879 they gave an acre of land to the African Methodist Episcopal Church to establish a chapel. And in keeping with the traditions of those days, these kinds of simple chapels also functioned as local schoolhouses. His stepmother was literate, by the way, which is also very unusual. So he got the rudiments of his education in Kahoma County. Mm-hmm. He also attended a school for black youth in Memphis for a while. But he was not a highly educated man. I found letters that he wrote in his own extremely careful and elegant longhand. He made all kinds of spelling mistakes. On the other hand,
although, had spelling been standardized by then? Because I know if you look back at some of the old writings of the 19th century,
that's true.
Things are spelled thousands
that's
of different
right.
ways.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you're right that explains some of them. But yeah. More important than that is actually the kind of gift for languages that he showed. Because I found very strong, clear evidence that he became completely fluent in French. He ran into an American reporter who took a liking to him in Monte Carlo in the 1890s. And the American reporter knew some French, but he was floored by the Parisian French that Frederick Thomas spoke. And when he switched to English, it was Southern American English. And that was a very piquant kind of combination. He also learned German. He picked up some Italian. And he was glib in Russian, in the sense that he made grammatical mistakes, but he could say anything he wanted.
Wow. Does that explain, I don't know which goes first, is it his musical ear that allowed him to have an ear for language, or was it his ear for language that got him?
Who knows? He never pursued the music, by the way. Yeah. It didn't work out in England. He tried to work his way through the music school. They wouldn't allow that. And the fact that he never
because
tried...
Because he was black?
No.
Or because
it wouldn't have been because of that. I don't know.
Okay. We don't know what kind of a singer he was?
I'm guessing that he probably wasn't good enough to do it as a career because he never tried it again. And since he was so determined to succeed at things that were important right. to him, he probably would have. But, you know, three of his sons actually had careers as singers in various places.
We're going to take the story to Moscow in a moment or two when we come back. Vladimir Alexandrov, our guest, The Black Russian is the name of his book on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. In Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE, I'm Mike Collins. Vladimir Alexandrov, a professor of Slavic languages, the B.E. Benzinger Professor of Slavic Languages and Literature at Yale University, our guest. He's the author of The Black Russian, which is the story of Frederick Thomas, a man born of parents who were former slaves in Mississippi in 1872 and who built a remarkable life for himself over the course of his 56 short years, which took him all over the world and to Moscow, which is where we're taking the story now, because he did go to other places. He went to London first when he went to that part of the world. In Russia, though, he became this remarkably successful businessman and theater owner. How long did it take him to do that? Because it would seem to me that anybody, whether you're black, white, doesn't matter what color you are, or what background you have, if you're an immigrant to a country, you are at a severe disadvantage for so many reasons. How is he able to navigate this foreign atmosphere and become as successful as he became?
That's a great question. I think it's a testimony to his genius for this kind of work. I mean, his profession was being a waiter and being a valet, which meant that he was a very good psychologist as well. Mm-hmm. He could understand what his clients wanted and how to treat them properly. He began working in Russia as a waiter. He very quickly became a captain of waiters, a maître d'hôtel at a fancy establishment in the city that was actually owned by a Frenchman. There were quite a few foreigners doing business in Russia. And there are recollections of how skillful he was. He could size up a customer as soon as the person walked in, pitch the customer in exactly the right way for the customer to feel welcome, remember what the customer wanted to order last time, and flatter the person by saying, I can get you what you wanted last time again. So he kept rising in the ranks. After he became a captain of waiters, he was selected by the owner of one of the fanciest restaurants in the entire Russian Empire in Moscow as a close assistant. So he was sort of in charge of other captains of waiters, and he made so much money from munificent tips. Grand dukes would give jeweled cigarette cases as tips, for example, to captains of waiters that they particularly liked, as well as merchants giving sizable cash tips, that he was able, with a couple of Russian partners, to rent a failed entertainment garden called Aquarium and to resurrect it. So within a year of their renting the place, it was making money hand over fist. He had made his first million. The entire time process took 11 years from the time he set foot in the country.
You've mentioned this entertainment garden a couple of times. Describe this, because I don't think this is something that exists anymore.
No, they were very popular kinds of establishments all over Europe and the United States at the beginning of the 20th century.
Isn't that what Madison Square Garden was originally?
I don't know whether that was originally the case in New York, but I think in Copenhagen there's a place called Tivoli, if I'm not
yes,
mistaken,
absolutely.
That still exists, which is a version of this. And I think in some sense, you know, Disney World is probably a latter-day version of it. But this was a several-acre park-like setting in near the center of the city. Which had trees and walkways, and it had a lot of different buildings in it, mm-hmm. enclosed theaters, band shells, and people would pay a fee to get in, and then if they wanted to go see a light play or an operetta, they would pay additionally to get inside the theater for that. Or they could simply wander the grounds and take their chances at open-air bowling or other kinds of activities of that. There would be hawkers selling various things. Or they could go to a more sophisticated sort of adult-focused kind of variety show. Adult, of course, in those days meant nothing like what it means now. It was quite innocent. But it could accommodate several thousand people at a time. There were probably a couple of hundred employees. There were restaurants. And these were very popular places for Muscovites to go. So this was what the aquarium was like. The Maxim establishment was a series of theaters. A stage with tables out front where people could sit, eat, and drink and watch or ignore the show that's going on stage. And there were more intimate settings in the same building as well. Thomas ran one called the Café Salon Harem, which is where so-called belly dancers, as I remember reading about it in someone's memoirs, would writhe provocatively on a carpeted floor while rich men, for the most part, sipped Turkish coffee and smoked Manila cigars and watched the show. There was a fair amount of very controlled kind of erotically inflected entertainment yeah. that was delivered, not only in Thomas's establishments, but in these kinds of places throughout Europe.
What made his so popular that it was one of the, I guess, premier establishments in Moscow by the time it closed?
I think his eye for talent.
He also produced the shows.
Oh, yeah. No, he recruited the acts himself. He would go with assistants to Western European countries, to all the big cities, Vienna, Berlin, Paris, go see the top shows and try to recruit the top acts for Moscow. And reviews of his shows all stress, you know, how overwhelmingly dazzling they were. And this would be everything from trained animal acts to an operatic diva singing to acrobats to comedians, magicians, variety, mm-hmm. vaudeville. So he would get the best acts. He also spent a lot of attention and energy on the decorations so that people would walk into his theaters would gasp at the luxury of it all. And he also was very talented in terms of the culinary arts. His food was famous. He knew enough about it to be able to make sure that the food that was served up was first rate. Mm.
So given the opulence of it all and the decadence of it all, I suppose, that would certainly make him a bright and shining target for the Bolsheviks when
Absolutely,
the revolution
yeah.
began. And that's where you begin your book. You begin your book with his harrowing escape from Russia on his behalf, with his family in tow, except for one daughter, I
right.
think. Is it Olga? Who went missing. Talk about that escape, because this too could be a movie, at least. Just the escape could be a movie from Russia.
Yeah, no, I could almost see Denzel Washington on the shores of Odessa planning to get on board a ship while chaos is breaking out all around him. Basically, what happened is that, first of all, Thomas had to escape from the Bolsheviks in Moscow in 1918 because his properties had been seized. He was having a lot of trouble making any kind of a living, and he had gotten wind of the fact that he was slated to be arrested for no other reason than he was the wrong social economical class from the point of view of the Bolsheviks. So he managed to get to Odessa, which is in Russia, but for various historical and political reasons was at the time in German hands. The First World War was not over yet still. But by virtue of being in German hands, he was able to get away from the Bolsheviks. Eventually, the French took over when the war ended, that territory, and they handled their occupation very badly. And they suddenly discovered that the Bolsheviks were coming. The French didn't want to fight them, and so they organized badly a very rushed evacuation. And lots of people wanted to get out because they knew what the Bolsheviks would do once they seized the territory. And Thomas, again, through his guile and his skill, was able to get himself on board a ship with the American consul's help. And they basically got out of the city on the night before the Bolsheviks occupied it.
Now, his passport had been, quote, lost,
right,
unquote. And he did not tell the Americans that he had become a Russian citizen, which would have made him ineligible for American diplomatic help. What you don't know can't hurt you, I suppose. So how he just the people just believed he was American because he was African American and he spoke English with a Southern accent?
Yes. Nobody ever doubted where he was from who came from the United States. So that when the American officials in Constantinople refused to recognize him as an American because he had no paperwork to prove it, this completely confused everybody who knew him because he could not have come from anywhere else except the American South. Americans recognized this immediately.
Right.
So that was enough. Enough for him to be able to lie his way on board that ship.
But he found himself in Constantinople, another foreign environment, different from that in Russia, and over the course of several years, did it again. He built himself another empire. He became the Sultan of Jazz.
He was the first to import jazz to Constantinople, which was becoming the musical rage all over the world. It had already left the United States and come to Europe and gone to Asia.
This is the early 20s?
1919.
Okay.
Was actually during the summer, was the first time he staged the jazz act. And more and more jazz acts appeared on his stages until he became the default place in the city to go to listen to jazz. And the Turks and the Europeans living in Constantinople all fell under that music sway, which is why they gave him that moniker when he died.
But they knew, I would presume that they knew who he was from his fame in Russia. I mean, he had some kind of a track record?
Oh, absolutely. No, he, in advertisements in Constantinople newspapers in 1919 and the 1920s, he would frequently allude to his fame in Moscow as a way of intriguing clients who would come because of that. Turks, incidentally, were not racist. You know, the Ottoman Empire had been multi-ethnic.
Right.
And so as far as the residents of Turkey, whether they were of European background or Turkish, they didn't care that he was black-skinned. There were lots of black people.
Yeah,
and the Americans were the ones who
And although Russia had a fairly lily-white population, the Soviet Union would go on to incorporate a lot of different races.
Well, actually, it began before the revolution.
Okay.
I found a very telling description of Moscow circa 1914 in this tourist guide for English-speaking visitors that I mentioned before, the Baedeker Guide, which described the motley nature of the street crowds in Moscow on the eve of the First World War. There would be people from various Central Asian locations wearing their national garb. So it was by no means the case that the crowds in Moscow in particular were all white-skinned or round-eyed.
Mm-hmm.
So although Thomas was very rare statistically, there were very few black people as such, there were lots of people of different colors.
So this man went from the Jim Crow South
to
the segregated North prior to the Great Migration, so they probably didn't know exactly what to make of him, and then to Europe, then to Russia, where he found great success, then to Constantinople, where he also found success in the colorblind freedom of Western Europe and that part of the world, Asia, Russia, only to fall victim later on to prejudice and even xenophobia.
Yeah, two different sort of faces of a similar problem. The prejudice came from the American diplomats that he had to deal with in Constantinople. Why did he have to deal with them? Because the country of which he had become a citizen had disappeared. The Russian Empire was no more. So his Russian citizenship was meaningless, and he wasn't about to try to go back to the Soviet Union when he had been threatened with arrest and possible execution. So he tried to resurrect his American citizenship, and the Americans wouldn't give it back to him. They obviously recognized who he was by his appearance and by his manner of speaking, but he had no paperwork to prove it. And the superiors of the diplomats in Constantinople, i.e. people in the State Department in Washington, did not find or did not try to find the documents in their records that proved that Thomas was American, documents which I found subsequently.
We're talking about The Black Russian. That's the name of Vladimir Alexandrov's book about Frederick Thomas, which is remarkable on so many levels as a story, as a book, as a one person's quest to find out who this man was. That would be Vladimir Alexandrov's quest to find out who Frederick Thomas was here this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Several of the reviews of your book comment on how detailed it is, and it is. I mean, you talk about what the streets look like, what the people look like, what the atmosphere around these places would be like, and they're not like that anymore. Some of the streets don't exist that he walked. Most of the places that he inhabited and spent time in, including his own establishments, are not there anymore. So how were you able to recreate those on the paper?
I read everything that I could about those places at the time that Thomas was there. I could get some insight into the places by visiting them now, even though they've changed. But between the recollections in diaries, letters, memoirs, and my own impressions, I was able to try to bring these places back to life, which is something that was very important for me, because I want the reader to get a feeling for these places, what they looked, sounded, and even smelled like.
And you went to a lot of these places.
Oh, I went to every one that I could identify, yeah.
But why? But what did that do for you as a writer? Because these places are not like they were in 1919 or earlier or slightly thereafter. What did that do for you?
It made the events of Thomas's life much more real. I'll give you one example. I found the place where Thomas's Maxim was in Istanbul. And I found where the old American embassy used to be in Istanbul, because obviously it's been moved to Ankara, which is the capital now. Mm-hmm. And the embassy building still stands. It's a very beautiful building, although it's boarded up. And so walking the distance from the nightclub to the embassy building gave me a sense of what it must have been like for Thomas when he was called in repeatedly by the American diplomats to explain himself. And the views, you know. Constantinople is a gorgeous city, and being able to see the views that existed during Thomas's time also made me understand some of the appeal of his locations.
I only have about 30 seconds left, but you wrote this in part because you are the product of Russian immigrants.
Yes.
And you say that you never really feel complete. Who are you? Which foot belongs in which country? And he had the similar problem. So that interested you. But aside from learning who this man was and empathizing with his position, what do you want the reader to take away from this book?
A sense of inspiration that can be gotten from the story of somebody who had to overcome enormous odds repeatedly and who managed to do it several times and to succeed in the end.
Vladimir Alexandrov, Dr. Vladimir Alexandrov from Yale, the author of The Black Russian, the story of Frederick Thomas, the unlikely ascent from Mississippi farm boy to Moscow impresario. Thanks for the hour.
Thank you.